following is Andrew Hinton's talk, Language is Infrastructure, from the 2014 Information Architecture Summit. The 2014 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by UIE's All You Can Learn. Stay tuned after the podcast for more information about All You Can Learn.
So, language is infrastructure. I'm going to start with an actual practical example. It's kind of a simple example, but it's one that's not that different from something I've encountered before. So let's say in this hypothetical situation, you're doing user experience work for a retailer's e-commerce site, and the project you've been assigned has what sounds like a clearly defined goal. Make the shopping cart easier to use. You know, people are complaining about it. Can you make it better? Okay, great. We all know what the cart is, right? It's been around on websites for a long time. But is it really that clear cut? So if you look at, for example, just the word cart, what does that mean? It's the kind of question that would seem to invite eye rolls and derision in a lot of IT meetings or planning meetings or project kickoffs, right? Like, you're already sitting at a project kickoff and you're the jerk piping up and going, well, hang on. What do you mean by cart? And people are like, can you just not be all weird? We have work to do. That exchange describes about half of my career. But here's the deal, guys. Joke's on them. Where's the cart here? So here's Target. So there's a little icon up there, little cart, little number on it. But look at all this other shit. Like, that's just some of it, right? So you've got the cart actually showing up in many places on the site, various forms. It's enmeshed with all sorts of other functions like authentication, store choice, product availability, shipping information. The cart actually changes what it is depending on where you are in a retail site for various reasons, some of them having to do with just how the infrastructure is created, the data and systems infrastructure, right, the services infrastructure, and some of it having to do with the steps and the things that customers have to deal with at certain stages in their retail work that they're doing on the site. You know, some of these things involve whole different sets of business rules depending on where you are in the process. Now, this might sound like a stretch, but I've run into this very kind of a thing before, right? As a consultant, being assigned to lead a team for cart and checkout. Well, guess what? Their cart and checkout team started at the cart page, right? And then went through checkout. But that meant that we couldn't make decisions about all the other instantiations of cart other than that one that's at the bottom right. Now, collaboration's fine and good, but the problem is that the way the organization was structured and the way the work was structured made it very hard to collaborate with other teams who were dealing with what cart instantiated itself as in other parts of the experience. And not even to mention the mobile team, which was like, you know, they're special. They're off in some other area doing mobile things, right? So I can't be the only one who's encountered something like this, where you're just trying to get to the bottom of what is the nature of the problem? What are you actually trying to do? And the other issue being that you feel like everybody around you thinks it's so simple, but you're looking at it and going, wait, there's all of this complexity going on under these rubrics, these labels you guys are throwing around. So the cart isn't just the cart. It's a signifier we use as shorthand for a hugely complex cluster of business rules, infrastructure, not to mention interactions, behaviors, and all of these are involved or made of language. And the only way to work this out is to have a conversation about it, to unpack the parts, gain some consensus or direction on what the mission is. This is a simplified example, but I know I'm not the only one who's hit this scenario before, or something like it. So, more often than not, there's just not time or willingness to stop making stuff to have a conversation like that. So, design is obsessed with the tangible for good reason, right? Everything else kind of feels secondary and peripheral to these objects that we can see or touch. There's so much to think about with things like icons or GUIs or Internet of Things, widgets and gadgets. It's all very interesting and necessary. But here's the thing. Too often, we don't talk about what's underneath all of that, what ties all that stuff together. It's the context that makes all these physical and virtual objects valuable or meaningful, and the stuff that connects them and that defines them. So a phrase I hear a lot is, that's just semantics. And you know what? Sometimes it's deserved, because sometimes, and mea culpa, right? I've done it. It's a lot of fun for some of us to get into these philosophical, semantic conversations, arguments. But the thing is that all of that noise that seems like noise is actually really hard work. it feels playful because sometimes it's fun, but it's actually people as an organism figuring out what things mean, what things are, so that they can do better, right? So they can grow. But this is the problem right here, is this stupid little word, just, right? Say that's semantics, not that's just semantics, because semantics isn't small, it's not inessential, it's not a deviation of purpose, but that word just diminishes it. And when we hear that, it's basically someone saying, I don't want to deal with that, I don't have patience for that. It's on us, though, to do a better job of having those semantic discussions productively, right? And to do a better job of that and to include people in those in a better way, but still. One reason why we have so much trouble with this is it's like a fish in its relationship with water. We're so immersed in language, it's such a native medium for human beings that we see right through it and we take it for granted. But it is a medium. It does have properties that we should understand. So, I do a lot of talks, and more often than not, my talks try to cram 20 different theses into one talk. Today, it's one thesis, and it's this. So you're going to hear me talk about this 20 different ways, okay? Because here's the thing is, I think as a community, and it finally occurred to me, the reason why information architecture has had such a hard time saying like what it is that we do or what that part of the work is because this is invisible to us. But it's our job to make it visible. So really my talk, like I said, just has the one message, and that's that language is a real medium for making. That semantics isn't fluff, it's not inessential, it's really crucially essential and central. It's not a disembodied layer of abstraction that we optionally add to the objects, places, and systems we design. It's instead both the body and soul of those objects, systems, and places. And in particular, language is what we use when we design the structure of information environments. That is, when we do information architecture. Language makes structures that are real and critical to our lives, just as these walls, floors, roads, and bridges. So I'm going to talk about this in several sort of loose categories, and we're going to start with organizations and how semantics function as a part of the environment of organizations. So some maps aren't representations of physical landscapes, but they're new environments in and of themselves. This was a meme that went around like a month ago, and it was, I guess, like the first real org chart, and it's beautiful. It's from the 1850s. For New York and Erie Railroad, and it's got this sort of wonderful organic kind of Victorian thing before the mechanistic metaphor completely ate management. I encourage you to go and find it. There's huge scans of it out there. But either way, you know, org charts are representations of social relationships, processes, collaborative structures. This railroad company spread out geographically over space and time zones. They needed an architecture that virtually organized all of their relationships, their work. An augmented reality architecture for existing as a corporate entity. When we create requirements or user stories in organizations, we're putting a lot of weight on language to define the shape of what we will produce. And these story sessions are supposed to be quick, go quick. But you end up writing crappy cards, right? Because you're not really talking about, wait, what is that? You know? Or at least get around to having that conversation. Because what happens is that's a mold that creates a thing in its image. And once that thing's made, it's really hard to unmake it. 10 years ago at this conference, Jesse James Garrett talked about how an organization's brand depends on the foundational meanings of the language it uses and how the structures we make need to take that language seriously. And we're still figuring this out. In the classic new management advice book, The First 90 Days, the author stresses that to work effectively as a manager or executive, you have to understand the cultural norms and fundamental values of the organization. Management has as much to do with the language of the company as with the budgets and reporting employees. Culture is a critical business concern, and our interface with that system is language. Organizations also have collective memories and shared narratives, and the arbitrary pathways of the past are often remembered as sort of a linear story that can be very convincing because it leaves out all the paths that weren't taken, and that story can influence future decisions. And likewise, even on a project level, that underlying story ends up being articulated in terms of interfaces, right? We need to add another tab to our global nav with my department on it. I need my thing at the top of that thing, right? Whether it makes sense or not. We need an app. We need to be more like Pinterest. Still hearing that one. Often, this is the best way stakeholders know how to talk about their issues, though, right? Is through that. It's our job to help them not step on that landmine, right? It's our job to say, okay, let's talk about the story underneath all of that. So language plays a critical role both vertically and horizontally in organizational life. Vertically, it starts as deep as the data structure, going all the way through the way software services work, the business rules that those software services are sort of putting out into the world, the corporate language, which is anything from the colloquial way that people talk within the organization, to one client I'm working with now, just about all the new employees they bring in when they get trained on all the crappy systems in the company first, and so their binder is organized. The table of contents is organized by crappy system one, crappy system two, crappy system three. I would say the names, but that would be out of NDA, so that's just a variable. But in other words, it's creating sort of a map of what that organization is that sticks with that person all the way through their career, right? How's that getting on the right foot? So, you know, I've been talking about language like it's stuff that's out in the world, because it is. It has a tangible effect on the work we do. It is environment. Language is physical. We make it, we consume it with our bodies. When we speak, we're using a great deal of our body to breathe, create the sound vibrations needed for articulation, not to mention gesturing like I'm doing right now. Not on purpose, but I'm just doing it. When we write, we're adding physical information to the environment that we depend on being picked up and interpreted correctly by a reader. We learn to read by reading aloud, so even when you read to yourself silently, when you get good at reading, science shows us that our body is still sub-vocalizing, our body is still firing neurons and doing things that it would do if we were saying it out loud. There's really no such thing as reading truly silently. Language is physical. There's mounting evidence that language has been with our species long enough to be a factor in natural selection, part of the environment that actually shaped our evolution. For example, anthropologists have shown there's a connection between language use and the ability to create sophisticated tools and weapons that can't just be figured out just by watching somebody. There has to be some kind of collaborative effort. The stone arrow tip that was found as one of these studies dates to many thousands of years before the actual emergence of Homo sapiens. Language has been with us since before we were us. Language is environment. It's stuff that we put into the world that allows us to make more stuff, including whole civilizations. Philosopher and writer Andy Clark, in his book on embodied and extended cognition, talks about how language is a kind of scaffolding. We create it so that we can go on to create more environment together. Likewise, names and categories allow us to rearrange the world magically. You know, we could take all this stuff in our world and just categorize it and then move it around in the abstract, but it's not really that abstract because it's a part of our world. So they add new structures to the environment, new objects, new places. Labels are powerful things. They're like a TARDIS. They're innocuously small and mundane on the outside, but immensely powerful, mysterious, and huge on the inside. Labels carry with them much of what the world is to us. They allow us to rearrange it, move whole universes of meaning with a breath or a scribble. And when we put labels into structures such as lists, we create new parts of our environment that enable new kinds of human activity. As Eco has said, it is the origin of culture. In archaeological digs, lists are the most common sorts of writing found. Most of them are about commerce and mundane record keeping. Why? Because writing was a necessary infrastructure for markets to expand over space and time, past the natural limits of human memory. Poets didn't need to write stuff down. They memorized it and they were out talking and saying it, right? It was these flunkies that were just trying to get work done that were making language, writing, what it is. As Patrick Lamb says in this really amazingly wonderful book that is expensive, but you should all buy and read, Organizing Knowledge, taxonomies provide the lenses by which we perceive and talk about the world we live in. Keep in mind that taxonomies aren't just hierarchies. Taxonomies can be lists, spectrums, facets, polyhierarchies, all sorts of arrangements of language that create environmental structures for action and understanding. And the reason why language can behave as environment is because it provides us a kind of affordance. James J. Gibson, who invented the concept of affordance, talked about how the structure of the surfaces and objects of our environment has a direct, mutually coupled relationship with our bodies. That's distinct from consciously uncoupled, which is a whole other thing involving Coldplay or something. This is mutually coupled relationship with our bodies, which pick up information about what our bodies can do with those structures, right? So these stairs are picked up by our perceiving bodies as a structure that will take us upward in space if we climb them. But we don't know where it's going to take us. We don't know the contextual significance of the stairs unless we go up them and find out for ourselves or unless somebody tells us. So the intrinsic affordance of the stairs is supplemented by a label, a semantic affordance. There's literature out there about semantic and linguistic affordance that it's different. There's different takes on it, but this is sort of the central issue. Now, Donald Norman calls these signifiers. He's worked for years trying to untangle the tangle that happened when he tried to use Gibson's affordance concept, or did wonderfully use Gibson's affordances concept for the design world. But I agree, these are signifiers, right? That's a signifier. But signification is a species of affordance. It's still structure that's in the world. We've just had to learn what it means, like at one degree removed. Gibson, when developing the theory of affordances, explained that affordance isn't just about simple perception between a body and a surface. He argued that affordances between people, because of language in particular, create extremely high levels of behavioral complexity and meaning. These affordances coalesce to become compounded, invariant structures in our environment that are cultural constructs rather than physical ones. So he talks about how a mailbox affords mailing a letter to another place. The intrinsic structure of the mailbox is just a hollowed-out object that affords putting things into, not even just letters. I mean, if you've got little kids, you know, right? Peanut butter. But for people encultured in a complex system of postal mail, we see right through just the mere physicality of this object. We see it as something that does this really complex thing. And of course, that construct allows us to completely abstract those affordances into something made entirely with bits and pixels. Here we have an even more complex system made entirely out of representations and metaphors of that box. That is, it's made entirely of language. It's not just dependent on it. Software, that's what we make. Placemaking and sensemaking are two words that keep coming up in our community, and good, because we need to keep working with these things and what they are. When you see a city scene like this, you see placemaking happening everywhere, through the signs and labels on buildings, but also through the conversations, publications, arguments, the narratives. In one sense, you know, I get Clark's metaphor about language as scaffolding, but when I see this, what I really see is kind of almost the opposite. I see culture and language that needed all of this stuff built to support it, right? It came first. This is the scaffolding, as far as I'm concerned, the built stuff. All it takes for humans to make something into a place is to say something about it, to name it, or mark it in some way. There were names for craters and mountains on the moon long before anybody walked on it, but when the first humans set foot, they marked it with this flag. There's no text on it, but it's still a rhetorical act. It's a semantic utterance. The official line was, "We come in peace for all mankind," but the subtext was, "Hey, Russia, look what we can do," right? It's wonderful irony that all of these flags have bleached white now. Digital networks make semantic environments a supercharged, geometrically more immersive and influential infrastructure that ends up changing the physical realities of behavior and place. Yelp adds a meaningful layer to the environment that changes the sorts of places that these are. And as a real physical effect that increases businesses to independent restaurants, because now people don't feel like they're risking anything to go. They know something about it. The chains are a known quantity, so why go there? Why go to Olive Garden if I can go to this awesome mom and pop Italian joint? In bit-based digital environments, we have very little physical structure to help us clarify what language means. We depend on the language for all of our structural affordances. So the stairs to the poetry room and the poetry room itself end up being conflated into these two-dimensional bits of language. This was the generative problem that spawned web-oriented information architecture. How to organize space where everything is made of language without the intrinsic structures of physical stuff to guide us. So when labels don't make sense in relation to one another, when the labels, connections, and rules are muddled, we're disoriented. Sense-making is stymied. Placemaking is dissonant. Here's the Facebook mobile app. Just look at that for a minute, see if you can figure out what those things mean. So, we have a, hey, yo dog, if you like newsfeed, I'm going to put a newsfeed in your newsfeed. I apologize for using a five-year-old meme, but I think it's apropos here. Why is there a newsfeed in the newsfeed? If I select most recent, I'm still in a newsfeed. What happened to the newsfeed? Isn't news new, but most recent is different? And so I'm going to see all my friends in some sort of like weird, not chronological order. These make no sense. They just don't. And actually, like a week ago, I noticed it disappeared off the app. So now you're locked into newsfeed, which is some mysterious Facebook algorithm. I have no idea what the hell they're showing me. At least I had some control here once I figured out what these things meant. These labels are not structurally clear, but what this is a symptom of an organization. And I know wonderful people work at Facebook. I understand. But we all work at organizations that get this stuff wrong. that they're like, here's a little silo of functionality. Here's a little silo. Here's a feature. Here's a manager or a director that needs to get something done this quarter so that they can get their bonus. So I want the most recent thing in there. I want the thing and the thing. And then you just jam all this Frankenstein crap together, and it just doesn't make sense. Because nobody talked about what is this. In Google Plus, which has gone out of its way to be very clear about context and the rules of privacy, there's still some wrinkles. So if I'm in my family circle, which is blatantly constructed like it's a room, like a place, if I go into the family circle on the desktop and I'm reading my family circle and I post, it automatically goes to the family circle. It makes sense, right? I'm in this room, I'm talking to you. You're talking to me or watching, whatever, right? We're in the same room. I don't then say something and then it's suddenly somewhere else. But on the mobile version, it takes like 6 interactions, even if I'm in one circle, to post something in that circle. So if I've gone from one to the other, it's just all kinds of confusing. But again, what this sort of comes down to is there are lots of requirements, obviously, got written. There are genius engineers in this organization and some amazing designers. But the architecture is fractious. The architecture is dissonant. The ways we enable and influence sense-making and place-making aren't just about a single website or app. It has to do with all the context that we encounter in something like this grocery store service experience, where you've got an ID card that's both digital and physical, that's connected to other information about you, that ties all of this stuff together. It has to be surfaced to you in a particular way so you understand what it is. You can go and find a specific kind of peanut butter on a specific aisle in a store. You can create recipes. All of these things working together, all this machinery, it's all language. Consider the whole ecosystem of information environments that make up the whole retail customer experience. All of these conversations, all the labels in the store and the organization there, and the expert reviews and price comparisons and all of that. Language. So all of this connects to systems. Like, all of this is part of complex things that are in the world, whether we made them or not. But most of what we deal with every day is stuff that we made. So it's on us. So let's talk about systems for a minute. Think about how the staring game works, right? So if I just walk up to one of you, I was going to just walk up to somebody and start staring, but I'm afraid I would actually trip off of this thing or something. So let's pretend I just walk up to somebody and start staring, and it would be off-putting, I'm guessing. I've discovered this, by the way. It was hard to unlearn doing that. But if you just walk up to somebody, hey, let's play the staring game. What is that? Well, we have to stare, and the first one to blink loses. Okay, suddenly there's an architecture, like a simple little architecture in between you that's a structure that you're both living in together, right? All games work this way. And in fact, all human systems that we create together work this way. So think about baseball. The fact that all of this activity in baseball is guided by a collective agreement to follow a set of rules. There are objects like bases, but almost everything else is just drawn on the field. Right? It's just language. And then there are very few physical structures other than that. There's no rails that you have to stay on to connect the bases. There's no like big robotic arm that takes a failed batter and like plops him back in the bullpen, right? They just go. It's like there are these structures that you don't see, but everybody just assumes they're kind of there. This is how civilization works. When rules change without everybody being on board, by the way, bad things can happen. This is Sweden in 1967, the day after a law passed that switched the side of the road. Not everybody knew, apparently. This is basically what happens on Facebook when they change their privacy stuff. John Coleman, I owe you a drink if you're in here. I'm sorry, I'm beating up on your beloved employer. I really apologize. Even our economies depend on the way that we define linguistic structures and objects that are part of that system. Money is made of language. It's just agreements between people. It's just people saying, okay, yeah, that's worth that. Sure. And then we abstracted it into currency. But just the other day, the U.S. Internal Revenue Service ruled that they will define Bitcoin as property, not currency, which literally changes what it is. It literally changes what we can do or not do legally, structurally, systemically with Bitcoin. Now, that hideous chunk of content on the right is the official IRS notice. It's hideous because it's not really written for consumers. It's new machinery added to the vast cultural machine of documentation, right, that has to be there to sort of shore up all of this activity. It has to be articulated. The law is essentially language machinery. What we're creating is new legislation, right? We're creating new structures, new places. But, you know, we poo-poo stuff like this, but at least somebody is sitting down and thinking about what the hell this stuff means. Maybe just to cover their ass, but they're thinking about it. So actually being able to articulate what something is, extremely important. So business rules, systems, maps, environments, they all depend on or are inseparable from language. And this means that we have to take language seriously and understand the nature of this material and the infrastructures and influences it creates. I foresee a near future where design schools or programs or mentorship or whatever involves talking about linguistics and semiotics, not just to sit around sounding smart, right? But I mean, I didn't study this stuff really in school. I've had to pick up on it since because I started realizing I need to understand how this stuff works. The clay under my hands, what is it? Because it's doing weird things. I'm not sure why. I'm assuming things about it that it ends up not being. So the same way we need to understand how CSS and HTML relate to each other or how a data stack works or a presentation layer is connected to it, this is what this is. It's the stack of language. Ultimately, all of these things tie back to it. So I'm going to finish with three thoughts to sort of riff on this whole thing. First thought, modeling is making. In a previous article I wrote on this topic, I argued that planning is making. I still think that good planning is making, but that's a harder argument to make in a two-minute slide. But good planning involves modeling, taking tacit abstractions and complex entities and dynamics and making them into objects that we can work with in time and space with our bodies. Good modeling is actually prototyping. It is. Everybody thinks that prototyping is not prototyping unless you're making something that looks like a product. But to people who make products, this looks a hell of a lot like making a product. After a while, I'm assuming you get to the point where you're like, oh, we keep making crap. Maybe we should think about it. And this is important. So you're prototyping your understanding of the problem and eventually the solution. It's not valuable in and of itself. It's valuable as a way to achieve a collective understanding and a shared vocabulary. Scaffolding for collaborative knowing. This is hard work. It is design work. And whether it's a month of workshops or a five-minute conversation over a bar napkin, it is important work. Second thought. Business rules are everybody's responsibility. All of these systems are built up from what companies call business rules, and I want to say clearly that these are your responsibility, no matter where you are in the line of the work that's being done. If you're the wireframe flunky who is just like, don't think, just take these requirements and make a thing, then figure out a way to ask, hey, why this business rule like this? Because here's what's going to cause to happen. Maybe we could rethink that. Even if UI is your focus, this is a conversation that's important, not just for that project, but for your career. So as our practice matures, we need to be able to participate in these discussions that determine the nature and overall direction of our work. Business rules are a story the business is telling itself. It's often up to us to dig underneath those stories and figure out what's driving them. And last, there's really nothing that matters to us, to humans, that isn't somehow wrapped up in language. The ancients who first used the word poet were using a word that meant maker because they understood that the poet makes more than poems. The poet makes worlds. We are a linguistic species, grit and gristle, halos and horns. We're immersed in symbol and suffused with story, and it's language all the way down. Thanks.
Yeah.
Actually, it's a quick plug in a sense. I'm glad that your diagram had pragmatics on the outer circle. Because too many...
I stole that diagram, so whoever I stole it from gets credit.
Well, it's awesome.
Yeah, because, we're good. Okay.
Too often in linguistics, it stops at semantics. And linguistic anthropology in particular, that's the plug for an entire discipline.
David is plugging linguistic anthropology. Just make sure you're...
Goes really deep on pragmatics. And I think for us, as user experience, information architects, yeah, whatever the hell we're calling ourselves today, that pragmatics layer is where
it's at. So, yeah, that's where it's at. So tell us what pragmatics is.
So it's language use in context.
Absolutely.
By observing language use in context, contextual inquiry, ethnographic interviewing, we can get a better sense of meaning. So when we try to communicate, we can actually align our meaning to the meaning of our audience through studying pragmatics. So
I just want to riff on that a second, because since it wasn't actually a question, I'll pretend like it was. I'm kidding. No, I'm kidding. No, Dave and I go way back. We're good. That's a great point, because here's the thing, is that most sort of classic IA method doesn't acknowledge that the context of the language changes what it means. Card sorts are done out of the context of the actual work that that semantic stuff is intended for. It doesn't mean you can't learn something from them, but you can go really, really wrong with it. You shouldn't depend on it entirely. There's lots of other situations. The mental modeling method that a lot of us have used, it takes a lot of the semantics that we hear in interviews and then brings it into sort of a vacuum where we figure out a kind of platonic clustering. But the truth is that actually has to work for people coming at it from all kinds of different pragmatic angles and contextual behavior. So that's a personal thing that I'm kind of obsessed with, is this idea that how do we evolve these tools we've been using for the last 15 years to acknowledge, because we didn't have to think about this so much because everybody was sitting in front of a desktop computer. We should have been thinking about it more, but, you know, you do what you do. Now we have to. We really have to. Anybody else?
It's almost like Andrew should write a book about something like this.
About this context thing? I think it's just a buzzword, honestly. I don't think.
That could sell. Yeah, I think it's just, okay. We have another question here.
Hey, thanks for the great talk. So suppose I'm a CEO of a major information providing company, and I came to this lecture, and I drink your Kool-Aid 100%, and I say, Andrew, I'm going to put you in charge of every single thing having to do with information in my organization. What are you going to do?
Honestly, I'm going to say that's a bad idea, because information should not be, I mean, it depends how you do it, I guess, but information doesn't seem to me to be something, it's like having a chief of innovation. That's just stupid. It's ghettoizing the thing. So
don't dodge the question. Tell us what this really
means. No, it's not a dodge. I'm not being a dick. That kind of decision, you saw the org chart. That's an infrastructure decision. So my first call as that hire would be, let's rethink what you think this is. Because what we need to do is actually educate the organization in thinking architecturally, in thinking linguistically, and having some rigor and discipline about what they're doing. It's an uphill battle, though, because everybody's just trying to get stuff cranked out, right? So, I mean, we have a hard time just getting people to sit down long enough to do a usability test, much less having a meeting where we're like, well, okay, what do we mean by cart here? So I don't know if I've got a great answer to that, other than that would be a conversation to really do some hard work, like that, you know, scribbles and modeling on the whiteboard. You have to sit down with that executive and go, okay, well, let's figure out how to solve the problem that you came to me with in the form of a solution.
Thanks.
If anybody does want Andrew to work on their information, I believe you talked to Bob Royce at Understanding Group about that.
We didn't pay her for that plug.
So you touched a lot on the similarity of language, how something can go across, say, ages like the spearhead. But there's also many changes. I saw an article this morning where an airline employee who had to give a note that someone was deaf put deaf and dumb, which offended the person, and now the airline is going to take action on that individual because it is a disparaging term now. But the word dumb, the original word for dumb was mute. And now it has changed to something where it's simple or stupid, but the person was actually using the word in the original context. And I guess in the bit world, you have the disk as a save, and we have 23-year-olds in our shop that's never seen a disk. So how do you account for the change of not only the visual language, the semiotics, where you're using things that have no context for people now, and the actual changes through, I guess, all the layers of language?
I don't have an answer for that that would fit the time that I have to give an answer to that, other than, you know, I feel like part of the curriculum of design and part of the kind of design thinking and all that other stuff, it needs to be a little smarter about meaning. And, you know, again, it used to be that big companies had a lot more control over the context in which their communication was happening, and most of it was one way. And now it's gotten more complicated. So I don't know what else to do other than to say we need to keep developing. Just like we have other models we can point to that say, you know, a color wheel or whatever. I mean, you know, we got stuff. we need stuff about this, and we just need at least some surface understanding among people to kind of think about it. That original issue about the deaf and dumb thing is, I don't know what to do about that other than cut somebody maybe a little bit of slack and just apologize. And then the save icon issue is really, you know, this whole flat versus Skoya whatever thing is really about semiotics. It's really about affordance and how language affords things. And so it's really not about aesthetics or taste, but that's been the red herring. So I think that's kind of what that's getting at. Yeah.
All right, last question, Peter.
I don't know if it's much of a question more than a comment. First, thank you. This was excellent.
Okay.
The language all the way down, and I love Yertle the Turtle. It's probably my favorite Dr. Seuss story. So I wrote a post about how UX stunted information architecture, and it was probably mistitled. It should have been how IA stunted itself by falling under the umbrella of UX.
Yeah.
And I think language all the way down in the org chart addressed two parts of that. At my company, so I work at Groupon, where people sit is determined by our taxonomy. And that taxonomy was not meaningfully constructed at the outset. It was just kind of thrown together really quickly because we needed to scale crazy fast. And now that we're trying to overcome some of the limitations of our taxonomy, it is so deeply embedded in the core operations of our system that it's actually really difficult.
Yeah.
And so just kind of wanting to basically support what you're saying and encourage folks to encourage your organizations, particularly early on, to be exceedingly mindful of what Andrew's been talking about, because it has real-world, honest, deep impact, particularly if you find yourself succeeding. And this community, the IA community, has an opportunity to influence that impact that I don't think it's really taken advantage of, because it's gotten too associated with interfaces and not enough with those organizational realities that you referred to at the outset. So,
thanks for that. No, that's totally true. You know, I mean, this wasn't all clear to me from the beginning. I mean, it's in trying to write this book that Abby was referring to, which I'm hopefully finishing sometime this year, about context, that realizing that it really is all for humans, it's all bound up in language. And when I started kind of, it gave me these x-ray specs, and then when I started seeing things like what you're talking about, I oh my God, it's everywhere. It's like, what's that movie with Roddy Piper? They Live, yeah. It's like that. It's like you put it, it's like, oh shit, there's like these crazy things everywhere that are making people do weird stuff, and they don't see it. They don't see it. And sometimes in order to do good work, good, especially information architecture work, you have to make them see that stuff so they understand how much crap they really need to bust down and redo. They can't just layer new semantics on top of it, right? It's not going to fix it. You sure as hell aren't going to fix it with UI. So thanks for that point, Peter. That's great. Okay, thanks, everybody.
All right, that was another. That was amazing, right? Did I promise amazing? Can we get louder? Woo!
The 2014 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by UIE's All You Can Learn. UIE's All You Can Learn will give you the skills and techniques you need for a competitive design advantage with 24/7 access to UX experts and topics. For more information, visit aycl.uie.com. That's aycl.uie.com. As always, thank you for listening.